Good morning. It's so good to be here with you on this gorgeous sunny morning in this beautiful country church, in this warm and welcoming community. I have stolen Mark's opening words from him, and I appreciate his graciousness around that. And the reason why is because this is one of those days that invites us to look at the spaces in between us and the spaces between what we had planned and what comes to be, and find there the spirit of something more. Our children, as many of you know, have departed or are in the process of departing for a canoe trip. We wish them a safe and wonderful adventure on the water. Certain elements of the service are going to look a little different in their absence, and so I'll try to cue you as those go. We also have a couple of changes to the order of our order of service, and I'll mention those as well. The most important thing that I want to put before you, though, is an invitation for those of you who have some extra time after the service to go get coffee. I will probably take this hot robe off, whatever you need to do to make yourselves comfortable, and then in about 10 minutes after the service, maybe around noon, to come back into the space if you're interested in having the traditional Q&A discussion. This service may bring up some themes that you're interested in exploring, and we will also do joys and concerns at that time as we come back together in a spirit of discussion in community. Again, welcome. And now I invite you to settle into your seats with these words from Unitarian Bets Wynicke. As we gather this morning, may we learn to recognize and affirm the pieces of possibility, the bits of good that we bring. May we encourage rather than control. May we love rather than possess. May we enable rather than envy, allowing our individual gifts to weave a patchwork of peace, the soft, deep blue of sensitivity and understanding, the red energy of creativity, the white heat of our convictions, the risky, fragile green of new growth, the golden flashes of gratitude, the warm rose of love. Each of us, all of us, are indispensable if we are to minister to a broken and wounded world. Together in our gathered diversity, we form the whole. So may it be.
For our members and guests, please know that we are a welcoming congregation. Whether you seek religious freedom or freedom from religion, you are welcome here. Regardless of your sexual orientation or gender identity, you are a valued member of this community. We do not exclude anyone for their racial, ethnic heritage, their age, ability, or education. We only ask that you respect one another according to the seven principles, which you can conveniently find on the back of your bulletin. So good morning. My name is Mark Clark. If you showed up hoping to see Scott Tenona, I'm sorry, you're going to have to put up with me. He had something come up, and he had to leave town rather quickly. So I'd like to get just a couple of announcements real quick. Our members, Sarah Lott and Alex Stinson, most of you know, are moving to Vermont and on July 30th, so just around the corner. And Sybil Perkins and Dave Lambert would like everyone to come to their house at 1105 Mill Knoll Terrace. I can give that to you later if you didn't catch that, for a farewell today for them. They hadn't been here that long, but they really became an integral part of our congregation. We're going to miss them. The times are between 3 and 5:30 today, so they're actually up picking up Sarah's dad from the airport right now. Otherwise, they'd be here. I guess I should probably introduce Reverend Jordan Nelson Long now. Pleased to have her here today. She's the interim minister at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church in Kansas City, Missouri, and maintains a long-running blog at raisingfaith.net, and which you should check out. I had a little bit of time to the past couple days, and it's very interesting reading. And she very briefly describes herself as a mom of two, a Unitarian by denomination, a Christian Universalist at heart, and an Evangelical Lutheran Church of America, Lutheran, the Swedish kind, she says, in her upbringing. She's also a non-practicing lawyer and a reluctant homeschooler, and is a class of 2016 seminary student at Meadville Lombard Theological School. So we're pretty excited to have her here for the third or fourth time. We're not sure, but and she'll be coming back later at another date, so stay tuned for that. Okay. So it's now time to light the chalice, and I thought I'd do this a little bit differently. There are usually some very inspiring words spoken at this point, but I hope this inspires you as well. A little bit of background, why we do it, why it's a chalice and a flame. So as we light the chalice, as we do every Sunday morning, let's consider why we do so. The flame within a chalice, and a chalice is a cup with a stem and a foot, is a primary symbol of the Unitarian Universalist faith tradition. We kindle a flaming chalice in gatherings and worships, featuring the chalice symbol prominently, like the one etched on our round window just outside of the sanctuary. The history behind how the chalice became our symbol involves an Austrian artist, Hans Deutsch, who first brought the chalice and the flame as a Unitarian symbol during his work with the Unitarian Service Committee during World War II. To Deutsch, the image had connotations of sacrifice and love. As Unitarian Universalists, we have many different interpretations of the flaming chalice, including the light of reason, the warmth of community, and the flame of hope. As we light the chalice this morning, I invite you to reflect on what this symbol of our faith means to you. For our opening hymn, please turn in your gray hymnal to number 188, Come, Whoever You Are, and we'll sing it two times through.
What can they do to you?
Whatever they want.
They can set you up, bust you. They can break your fingers.
Burn your brain with electricity. Blur you with drugs till you can't walk, can't remember.
They can take away your children. Wall up your lover.
They can do anything you can't stop them from doing.
How can you stop them?
Alone you can't fight. You can fight. You can refuse. You can take whatever revenge you can.
But they roll right over you.
But two people fighting back to back can cut through a mob. A snake dancing fire can break a cordon.
Termites can bring down a mansion.
Two people can keep each other sane, can give support conviction, love, massage, hope, sex. Three people are a delegation, a cell, a wedge.
With four, you can play games or start a collective.
With six, you can rent a whole house, have pie for dinner with no seconds, and make your own music.
13 makes a circle.
100 fill a hall. 1,000 have solidarity and your own newsletter.
10,000 community and your own papers.
100,000 a network of communities.
A million our own world. It goes one at a time.
It starts when you care to act.
It starts when you do it again after they say no.
It starts when you say we and know who you mean. And each day you mean one more.
I would now like to invite Katie. And I would be inviting the young and young at heart, so we're going to have to go with people who feel like volunteering. I need Katie, and I would love to have two volunteers. And this is actually going to involve everyone, and I promise it's not painful or even embarrassing. Hands, anybody, people who are willing to volunteer? Okay, we've got one and one over there. Awesome, thank you. I feel like we're preparing for a magic show here, and I've got my trusty assistant and my able volunteers. Anna, and tell me again.
Anna and Jane.
Okay. Anna, Jane. Thank you so much for coming up and volunteering. We are going to talk about fair and equal. So my trusty assistant, Katie, assistant in theology, is now going to make sure that both Anna and Jane have an equal, exactly equal amount of crackers. Let's make sure we agree. It needs to be equal.
Okay. So it's a little deceptive here because the platters are different sizes. So there's some.
All right. So how can we make sure it's equal?
Okay. Estimated counting. Okay.
All right. Do you guys agree?
Yeah.
They equal? Okay. You want to show the audience? Do we agree? Equal? Is this fair? At this moment, is it fair that Jane and Anna have an equal amount? Okay. What did you have for breakfast this morning, Jane?
I had a liquid protein drink.
A liquid protein drink. What did you have for breakfast this morning, Anna?
I had a liquid protein drink and an English muffin and 2 cups of green tea.
Oh. Interesting. So what do we think, guys? Is this still fair, having an equal number?
I need more.
Okay. Jane is now saying this isn't fair. So Katie's job here is always to make it fair. And your job, you guys are the court of public opinion, your job is to, with your voices and with your hands, say whether or not this is fair. All right, show your trays, Jane and Anna. Are we at fair? Yes? No? Give me thumbs. All right, I'm not seeing any dissent here. How is your stomach feeling now? Are you hungry at all, Jane?
I am.
Jane is hungry. Should we check with Anna?
I'm not hungry.
Oh, Anna's not hungry. Now is this fair? What do you guys think? Jane is hungry. Anna is not hungry. What should we do with these crackers? Anyone, shout it out. Give Jane more? Jane should eat some. Anna's saving for the future. Okay, I did hear somebody say that we should give Jane more. So we'll work on that.
Thank you, Anna.
All right, show your trays. What do you think, court of public opinion? Is this fair? Okay, we've got a thumbs down. Tell me about that. Talk loud.
Jane should eat something and then see how she feels about it.
Okay, and why does that matter? And so we're wanting to solve the hunger problem and then decide about who should have extra.
Right.
Okay. Solving hunger first makes sense?
To me.
Makes sense? Yeah. Court of public opinion? Okay. There's another thing about these crackers. They are gluten-free crackers. How do you feel, Anna, about gluten-free crackers?
I actually like them.
Oh, Anna likes gluten-free crackers. Okay, how about you, Jane?
Yeah, I don't require them, but I like them.
Okay. Jane doesn't require them. She likes them. Do you require them?
No.
Are you? Okay, okay. There's one other thing about these crackers. I accidentally grabbed the wrong box in the store, and they are Cool Ranch flavor gluten-free crackers. How do we feel about that?
That sounds good.
Well, that sounds yummy. Remember, Jane is hungry.
Yes. Doesn't matter to me one way or the
doesn't
other.
Doesn't matter. Okay, so one of them thinks they sound good, and one says, All right, court of public opinion, we've got to still make it fair. How is this going to be fair? 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 It doesn't matter at all. Okay. What about if I told you that our job now is to make sure that all of these people, because we care for this entire community, it needs to be fair for everyone in here. How would we do that? Would we give everybody the same number of crackers? How would we solve this problem at this moment? Oh, we've got people who don't like ranch. I'm with you, actually. When I realized, I thought, this will be perfect for a church experiment. Anyone else? How could we make it fair for everybody here? See who's hungry. I love that people are bringing that up, because what we are talking about then is not equity. We're talking about fairness in a different way. We're talking about the concept of justice. And we believe as Unitarian Universalists that justice is what we're going for in our human interactions. Do we always have to agree about how we're going to get to justice? Are we going to agree? Do you always agree in this community? We may not even agree about what justice looks like. And we had a dissenter over here. What's your name?
Chris.
Chris. I won't just label you dissenter. Chris lifted up a thought that it really matters what happens when somebody is eating to solve their hunger. We have to do that before then we decide what to do with the extras. Those are the kinds of points that are rational thoughts might lead us to make, and we believe those are important, right? Like, that's part of our faith tradition. So different ways of solving this problem can all be brought into this room, but it's also important that we, in the end, we're going for justice, and that might look different than our first attempt at just making sure that things are exactly even. It's a simple solution, though, so our society likes to go for that one and stop there. Can I have a round of applause for my assistant Katie and for Jane and Anna? And you may be gratified or horrified to know that these very crackers will be available to you during coffee hour. Thank you. Would you guys mind taking them to the kitchen? Thanks. We are. Thank you so much.
This is Ella's song, lyrics and music by Bernice Johnson Reagan. Performed by Sweet Honey in the Rock.
Wow, right? As we move into our deepening portion of worship, into our meditation, I offer you these words from the Reverend Odette Fulbright. She wrote them the morning after the Ferguson grand jury declined to offer an indictment. Some morning you rise broken and hung over with weariness and pain, with rage tattered from waving too long in the brutal wind. Get up, child. Pull your bones upright. Gather your skin, your muscle into a patch of sun. Draw breath deep into your lungs, for you will need it. Another day calls to you. I know you ache. I know you wish that the work were done and you and everyone you have ever loved were on a distant shore, safe, unafraid. But remember this. Tired as you are not alone. Here and here and here also, there are others weeping, others rising, others gathering their courage. You belong to them. They belong to you, and together we will break through and bend the arc of justice all the way down into our lives. The Black Lives Matter movement and its struggle may not feel like your movement yet, but I know that you are people of struggle, people of courage, people of faith, people who have gotten up time and time again and walked it to the Capitol in Topeka and done what you had to do. Our people are those people, and we will continue to do that work. In that spirit, let us move into a time of silent reflection, lifting up whatever is in our hearts. We will conclude our time singing Return Again. We'll call that a conveniently timed chime. I'd like to invite you to grab your teal hymnal. This is a song from the Jewish tradition. It can be sung as a round, and I often joke that my gift to the congregations I visit is not singing from the pulpit, so I will try to offer you that gift today also. If we have people who are familiar with the song and people who feel inspired to lift their voice, especially with the higher harmony of the second verse as we continue singing, please feel free to do that. We'll go ahead and sing this through a few times. Thank you. There is actually a mistake in the title of the service as it went out on the internet, and it's an appropriate one. The title that was published was You Could Be Wrong, and that actually was the title of my sermon the last time I was here. This is actually called We Could Be Wrong. And what I mean when I say we, what we ministers mean so often from the pulpit, is I could be wrong. We share stories from the pulpit as our business, and when they are stories of success, they are so often your stories. When they are the tales of screwing up, they are our stories. And I mention that and encourage you to hold this story in the fullness of grace as we learn forward together. Last summer, I spent a few nights in a hotel in Chicago, a 4-star hotel. Thank you, Hotwire. I'm a return guest to this hotel, and I booked the reservation in a hurry. I had changed my plans, and I put the room in my husband Craig's name without realizing it. He had used our account last. You're not supposed to even be able to check into a hotel room without matching identification, and yet there was no problem. Welcome back, Mrs. Long. Things were so smooth checking in that I did not even realize that only Craig's name was on that reservation until a couple of days later. I went down to the gym and I left my key next to the elliptical cycle. Locked out of that keyed access fitness facility and also out of my room, I went down to the lobby in my running clothes to ask for a new key. And as I got to the desk, sweaty and with my headphones draped around my neck, it occurred to me that I also didn't remember my room number. And so, laughing, I explained the situation to the woman behind the desk. Her name was Maria. She wasn't laughing. And after typing some things into her computer, Maria refused to let me into my room. And in fact, she asked me to stand away from the desk to wait until security could come. I was astonished. And then I was angry. The mistake, of course, was mine, and in this era of caution, it makes sense to treat this kind of situation, to treat me, in fact, with suspicion. And yet I am not accustomed to being treated with suspicion. That's not something with which I walk through my days. In fact, I am not willing to be treated that way, or at least I wasn't that day. I felt my anger rise, and I took a deep breath, and then I stepped back to the line of people and waited politely but firmly off to the side as Maria finished helping her next guest. And then I asked to speak to a member of management. I waited calmly. I was certain that the ridiculousness of the situation would be resolved in my favor. And guess what? It was. A tall, white man dressed in black, he was about my age, strode across the lobby. He looked annoyed. Maria gestured in my direction, and his expression changed as he walked over to me. I smiled self-deprecatingly, explained my mistake at the health club, shook my head, and Scott saw me. He understood me. We were confederates in that moment, and then I put my serious face on and expressed my disappointment at having to wait for something as simple as being let back into my room as a repeat guest of this hotel. I did that. And guess who Scott was annoyed with now? Guess who got a room key? Guess who got in trouble? After verbally reprimanding Maria, Scott explained that he would add my name to the reservation to prevent any future problems. And even then, I didn't realize the depth of my error. It took until the elevator ride back to my room for things to even begin to sink in, alone with that second key to my hotel room. I had never so much as showed a piece of identification. My white woman attitude was sufficient. I walk with unquestioned privilege a lot of the time, and that day I threw it around. I was able to hurt someone without one single person calling me to look at what I was doing. I believed that I deserved to be treated a certain way the way I have been treated most of my life, and the system around me reinforced that belief. Not only was I wrong, I made a series of mistakes and asked other people to cover for them. I was enforcing a hierarchy based only on getting my own needs in that moment met. I was acting out of entitlement, pure and simple. Did I explicitly consider race at any point during this interaction? No. And yet, can I be sure that my own indignant, "How dare you?" and subsequent one-upmanship toward Maria, a woman of color, wasn't racially tinged? No. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was. Stay tuned for why. The last time I was here, we talked about a concept called illusory superiority. Does anyone remember that? Illusory superiority is a failure to know our own weaknesses and our blind spots, and it contributes to errors in judgment. And there is great news, because the solution to illusory superiority is so simple. It's soliciting feedback from those who know us and listening to it. I mentioned that sermon, and I preached it first, because on a societal scale, illusory superiority, trusting our own first instincts a bit too much, it's called something else: implicit bias. Where we are making snap decisions, not just about our own strengths, but about the value, the role of others, particularly groups of people we do not know, we make assumptions, filter information, and we draw conclusions in the blink of an eye. And everyone around us does too. These conclusions are often unfounded, though, especially where race is involved. And there are ways that we can and should challenge them. Check this out. A recent study, the first of its kind, indicated that doctors provide different and better standard of care for white patients than for black ones. These were heart patients and doctors, caring doctors, none of whom reported overtly racist attitudes. They tended to significantly undertreat their black patients with high blood pressure. Their white patients with high blood pressure, meanwhile, were treated according to the established guidelines. That's interesting, but what happens next is the reason I'm telling you this story. Once those doctors received information about implicit bias, about how that manifests in medical care, the difference in their care for their black patients and their white patients essentially disappeared. Patient outcomes for black patients, predictably, started to improve. Doctors explained their initial decisions not to treat their patients using language of futility. They felt that diet, smoking, and failure to follow healthcare guidelines were responsible for black patients' blood pressure issues. And they concluded that medication and other therapies were thus unlikely to help. These same hesitations were never expressed about white patients, even at similar weight or income levels. Researchers at the University of Michigan, meanwhile, recently noted that white mock jurors also demonstrate racial bias when there is more than one race present and racial issues are not explicitly mentioned at trial. I'll tell you as an aside that there is no way to do this research with actual jurors. It would represent a massive infringement on a defendant's rights to use some of them as controls. So that's why we're talking about mock jurors. Unfortunately, however, we need only to look at actual outcomes in our actual criminal justice system to observe massive disparities at every step in the process, from investigation and arrest to charges filed, to prosecutorial strategies, verdicts, and media coverage. At any rate, when racial issues were brought to the forefront during testimony in those cases, the outcomes in the same cases tried with the same evidence by the same licensed attorneys. The attorneys were not pretending. Just with a different group of white jurors, the outcomes were different. And during that process, both groups of jurors were surveyed. The jury group to whom race had not been explicitly mentioned dealt with a deliberately ambiguous situation by assigning negative motives and maintaining an overall negative impression of the defendant of color. The jury group in which the racial difference was acknowledged by jury by lawyer statement did neither of those things. And so I wonder, are we not seeing race, or are we not seeing race? For issues as complicated, uncomfortable, and divisive as race in 2015 America, it's an adaptive challenge for which Baltimore or Charleston are just the current face. There is a real temptation to declare things hopeless. And so, knowing that information can change outcomes, that's incredibly important. We need to be the ones to carry that information back into our political system. And we might even call it good news, Unitarian Universalist style. I'm going to pause for a moment here and clarify that overt racism, a stated preference for, say, whiteness, that's not what I'm talking about in this sermon. If you truly, consciously believe that a black child is not deserving of all of the rights and privileges of freedom, we should talk. But I'm not talking to you now. And the reason is this. Implicit bias, like illusory superiority, it involves a complicated self-defensive brain process. And to undo that requires some self-awareness. It requires a wish for things to be different. And our Unitarian Universalist principles and your history as a continuously engaged Congregation for Social Justice, for the rights of all people, those point us toward that desire. Those make it clear how we might next act in this great struggle for justice. Our very faith calls us to make steps toward healing and reconciliation. So what should we do? And I'm preaching to the choir here, right? Right? Maybe not. Myself included, obviously. Have any of you here seen the Rodgers and Hammerstein musical South Pacific? Yes? Okay, a few. There is a song in that show called Carefully Taught. Does that ring a bell? You've got to be taught, the lyrics say, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. Oh, you've got to be carefully taught. My parents were not big theater buffs, so I first encountered that song in an anti-racism training. A local psychologist, Carol, explained that growing up in a Japanese family, she was taught that to be Korean is to be less than. Carol carried that with her all the days of her life, and her strategy was, forgive me my first thought, and help me take the time to have a more realistic, more intentional second thought. In other words, help me, O Spirit of Life, to take a breath and engage deeper thinking before I act, before I get back in line and demand that second room key. I personally can't remember any careful lessons about black people. I grew up in Wyoming. My immediate family were not overt racists, and there weren't a lot of black people around. My Lutheran confirmation classes sure taught me some things about Catholics, though. My parents, meanwhile, had some things to say about Republicans. And a couple of years ago, I had to notice that it was actually really hard to distinguish my thoughts about, say, Mizzou, much less my statements about their sports teams, from the same kind of thinking. Living in Lawrence, Kansas, can carefully teach you some things as well. The thing is, when it comes to something as systemic as racial bias, we are carefully taught things in non-overt ways. Society teaches us. You just saw what's good, what's pretty, what's fair. This is scary and sad and disturbing. And for many white people, it's also a little bit mystifying. So in case that's you, let's dig a little deeper. Because we do indeed have a black president. And there are other political and entertainment figures, from Condoleezza Rice to Naomi Campbell to Halle Berry to Beyonce, who make millions of dollars and provide strong role models, not just to black girls, but to women in general. And it has become rare in most places for most white people to hear an overtly racist statement, especially from anyone we know. So where is the racism? And where is it coming from? These questions are understandable, and they also provide a very convenient cover for me to refuse to do any deeper work on myself. A CNN report last fall argued that the biggest single threat to our national fabric in this time and moving forward is a new, subtle, institutionalized racism. They called it racism without racists. Part of this is just the water in which we swim. Implicit bias comes from implicit messages, and they're so hard to see. Consider these points about what it means to be white in this country, as distinct from being a person of color. These are from a project called Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack. It may sound familiar to some of you. When I'm told about my national heritage or about civilization, I am shown that people of my color made it what it is. I invite you to think as I read this list about how many are true for you. Whether I use a check, a credit card, or cash, I can count on my skin color not to work against the appearance of my financial reliability. I can swear or dress in secondhand clothes or not answer email without people attributing these choices to bad morals or to the poverty or illiteracy of my race. I can speak in public to a powerful group without risking putting my entire race on trial. And finally, I can be pretty sure that anytime I ask to talk to the manager in charge, I'll be facing a person of my own race. I screwed up in a way that causes me shame even today. And there is no clear solution to that mistake. There is no longer a Maria on the front desk staff of the Chicago Hyatt Hotel. What we have when it comes to race in our deeply divided country is opportunities to keep learning. And they look like opportunities to keep screwing up. We call it fail forward. Case in point, earlier this year, I made another mistake trying to speak articulately about my own privilege. I used words from a seminarian of color at the bottom of my own extremely entitled and somewhat clueless reflection. I asked her permission only later. I assumed that her values about having words shared would be similar to mine. I assumed that the world would see my efforts in trying to lift up this issue rather than ask me to consider the impact of my actions upon someone else. I was called to account very quickly by our community of Unitarian Universalists, by my community of seminarians. And I've walked with this as a failure, but I now understand it differently because I listened to that seminarian. I listened to her words. I didn't answer them with any of my own. And rather than claiming space or fighting back, I thought, I'm learning. I'm trusting your perspective. And we can do that. This is where it starts, in making the risky moves that the system says that we white people don't have to make. In hearing and telling the stories that our system says that we white people do not have to hear. And in moving toward real relationships in communities that will hold us accountable. This is what it means when we say we, and each day mean one more. And this is the space where we learn to do that. This is where we live into the hope and the promise of our Unitarian Universalist faith, carrying the belief that Black lives matter forward into our next years of work. May it be so. I invite you now to rise in body or spirit and join in our closing hymn, also in the teal hymnal. It's number 1008. When our heart is in a holy place. In the words of Unitarian Universalist Frederick E. Gillis, and from our gray hymnal, Singing the Living Tradition, we close with these words: May the love which overcomes all differences, which heals all wounds, which puts to flight all fear, which reconciles all who are separated, be in us and among us, now and always. Go in peace, and we will reconvene at 5 till, so in 10 minutes, if people would like to come in and share joys and sorrows, and also happy to do any Q&A and hear responses to the sermon. Thanks. Welcome back. Thanks for hanging in and experimenting with me on this particular framework, and we'll see what you guys think of it. I've so enjoyed being with your community these past few times. I will be visiting you one more time next month, and I'm looking forward to that too. We will go ahead and start with joys and sorrows. And Austin reminded me that this is being recorded, so unless anybody has a strong objection to that, it's for your community. So you guys decide how you want to do that and use it, but just as a reminder, I don't think it gets podcasted probably. But. All right, so who wants to start? And actually, since this is your community's tradition, I would love to have a convener of the joys and sorrows part who wants to lead that. And, you know. Or I can. Okay, does anybody have a... a joy or a concern, a sorrow that they'd like to share with the community? And maybe we'll just do it all together. You can do joys, concerns, or sermon talk back, and yeah, whatever comments you have.
Hi, Carrie Roberts. I don't know, I know a few people here know my mother, but she just spent 3 or 4 weeks up in Michigan taking care of her parents, and she got back Tuesday, and she's leaving to go back up there on Wednesday to move them into assisted living. So just thoughts for my mother for dealing with elderly parents and family drama and all the stuff that goes with it.
Chris Bailey, and not everybody was here, but some people were here when my dad, Larry, his concern was mother's eldest sister, my Aunt Michelle, and her husband were in a car accident. Her husband, Woody, died before he got to the hospital. And my aunt was pretty banged up. And for anybody who was curious about the status there, she is in a neck brace and a head brace for about the next 10 weeks, but she is expected to recover. So that's happening.
Well, I remember, was it 2 or 3 years ago when the kids were going to go canoeing and Larry fell the night before and broke his shoulder, I think it was? Yeah, so I was thinking about Larry this morning in that regard and being grateful for him that he's fully recovered, I guess. I hope so. Yeah, good. Oh, and I noticed in yesterday's paper that the lawsuit that Michael and Charles brought to get tax, they could, so that they could file their federal taxes as a married couple, that that's been decided in their favor. Yeah.
Mark, a joy in that Katie and Jessica Severs and I just spent a week, 8 days, whatever, up in Wisconsin at the Midwest Leadership School, and it was a great experience. And we're going to try recruiting more people to go, and especially youth. They run a concurrent youth school, a leadership school, which was pretty fabulous to be part of that group. So.
I'm happy also to take whatever questions or comments or inspired or even completely undeveloped thoughts that you may have about white privilege, implicit bias, stuff the sermon brought up for you. We can sit in relative silence and enjoy each other's company also.
Well, I'll dive in here and say something, and actually it's a sorrow too, so it segues for us, but when we got back from Midwest Leadership School, not long after that, the news about Ms. Sandra, whose last name, suddenly I'm going blank, thank you, was all over the news. And this deep sense of sadness, just, boy. And I want to share with you, I think partly why it hit me hard, is that I've been in a situation with police overstretching, overacting. Something happened to me in 2005 in a very routine traffic stop I ended up being threatened by the officer that he put my then 4-year-old in protective custody for the weekend. I eventually ended up in handcuffs in the Riley County jail. And I don't know to this day if I was treated different, maybe because I have dark hair and a more olive. I have no idea. But I mostly have tried to forget that incident and how traumatic it was for my child and for myself. And really, when I read the story about Sandra, all I could think is like, but for the grace of God, right? I mean, it really is unthinkable that we be free citizens and in the blink of an eye, incarcerated, or even worse, dead.
Well, I mentioned that we were just at leadership school, and I learned something that happened away from the lessons. It was out of the blue, and I think I'm still processing it a little bit. We had groups that met, groups of 5 or 6 or 7 daily, and it was organizational development. So there was actually the episode did happen in there, but it had nothing to do with a lesson. And a woman, the task we had for that day, for that 45 minutes or 50 minutes we were together, was to develop a definition of what a leader is in this context. And there was a woman in there that nobody knew. It was our first, I believe it was our first time together. And everything that she said during that time, you know, people brought up that they should be knowledgeable of the subject, and you know, all the things that you think traditionally a leader is. And but every word that she spoke was through a very tightly focused lens of racial equality, everything. And she was a white woman, red hair, and it raised the ire of us, partly because of her attitude, in other ways. But I'm certain it was also, you know, we were being lectured to by this white woman that, you know, we're all open. We're not racist. We're none of that, of course, overtly and hopefully not implicitly. But anyway, so a couple days later, I guess, we were at lunch, and this is where the lesson happened for me, my lesson. I said, "You pronounce your M's interestingly." Well, as it turns out, she's from South Africa. I was born and raised in South Africa and lived in the United States for a number of years, but nevertheless. And she experienced everything that apartheid had to offer, including a man that was hit by a car. Somebody called the ambulance. The ambulance shows up and then turns around because it's not a white ambulance. It's a white ambulance and not a white man. And so the man died by the time the black ambulance got there. She's also married, or at least has a partner that's African-American with 2 mixed-race kids. So she's seen all of the worst of humanity, and including the racism in here. And it got me thinking that regardless of her skin color, what's her point of view? Her point of view is as somebody that's seen the worst, but also as, you know, somebody that has to worry about her 2 African-American mixed-race kids and her African-American husband. So you can't just, I think the lesson should be obvious here. I'm still learning it, but it was come out of the blue. So, yeah.
Okay, so I'm just going to start out by saying racism is a label, and sometimes labels are inadequate. And frequently we all have different ideas that we use the same label. Maybe 2 people will use the same label, but they mean 2 different things. And the idea of racism is a very complex one. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background, because I think you'll see that depending on where you're coming from, it can look different, and you may not even know what people are talking about. I grew up the first 6.5 years of my life. Most of my friends and the people that really loved me and cared for me and were around me most of the time were brown-skinned people, because I grew up in South America and Argentina and in Uruguay. And my parents, who were from New England and as white as can be, were hardly ever around because they were hardworking embassy attaché and wife. and they were always having to go somewhere. I was a platinum blonde, curly-haired little girl, and the housekeeper and the cook thought I walked on water. And so they totally spoiled me, loved me, caressed me, held me on their laps whenever they could, and just gave me whatever I wanted all the time, you know. I left that life. I didn't really leave that life. I went from South America to the Far East and lived in another country, Burma, where all the people were brown-skinned. It was a similar situation. So it wasn't until I was 9 years old that I arrived in the United States in the totally white school system. There were no black kids in the school, and the poor folks that lived down, you know, one field across from us in Herndon, Virginia, were white poor folks. And boy, they were very, very poor. They didn't have any windows on their windows. And, you know, a lot of stuff like that. So it's just an interesting thing to me that when I was in boarding school, I gravitated to the laundry room where the black women were doing our laundry, where lots of laughter and singing was coming from. And so in high school, this is high school age, I loved to sit up on the counter and talk to these women who were ironing the clothes and washing the clothes and talking about all kinds of things. And I was pulled out of there by the headmistress of the school, an 85-year-old daughter of a plantation owner. These were the descendants of the slaves on her father's plantation that I was rubbing elbows with and having fun with. And she said, no, you can't. You're not one of them. What did she say? They're not like us, or something like that, right? And so I have a kind of a different place that I'm coming from when I think about it, because I was beyond the point where anybody was going to influence me. And I knew that these ladies were my friends, and they were lots of fun, and they were a lot more fun than a lot of the other people at my boarding school. There's a lot more I can say. Nowadays, I'm going back to my Latin roots because I'm learning tango and I'm spending time. And it's interesting that my group of people that I tango with are not just Latin, but they're Saudi Arabian, South Indian, and there's a lot of people of color in my group. So I feel right at home.
Jordan, I know you're not fishing for compliments, but you were wonderful this morning. Thank you so much. Because of the topic, I've just developed an incredible headache. And there's so much I could say from so many ends, and so I'll just sort of ramble for a little bit and try not to go too long. But I guess one thing is, this is just a little thought about the experience that you had. I've always really, and you know, maybe this is a fault of mine, but it's who I am, and I've always done everything I can to distance myself from this system. I don't see anything in it that I believe in. And I guess one thought that came to me was that I'm aware that often if I see somebody mistreat a waitress or somebody behind the counter in a store or something, or if something happens to me that is you know, out of whack that way. You know, like I forgot my key or whatever. It kind of becomes an automatic thing to me that if I do talk to somebody who's over them, I don't even think about it. I just sort of automatically say, and look, I don't want this person getting in trouble over this. You know, people make mistakes, every single one of us. And I never know when I walk away from that, you know. if they're going to give this person a hard time anyway. You know, it's just so absurd to me. This, the whole obscenity of capitalism is, it's a sickness, it's a disease. And the other part of this is, and this I feel so deeply, and I felt it since I was 10 years old. Something happened when I was 10 years old. It's like my whole worldview. Dr. King talked about militarism being one of the great sins that completely violates humanity. And I'm so aware now, especially how we are so unconscionably training young people to go anywhere they're told to go and kill anybody they're told to kill, and to do it without remorse, without feeling. That militarism is the most obscene thing I can imagine. And then when they come back, so many of these people come back from these wars and they end up homeless, or they end up working as policemen, or they end up working as guards in prisons. They're damaged, they're broken. And I'm not saying that vindictively. I have nothing against these people. I'm not saying all soldiers are evil people. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying we're creating a really horrific, monstrous thing here. And this is, again, it seems to me so obviously evident that we have to speak. If we want to end racism, we have to also end militarism. And those two things go hand in hand, and we have to shout about it and wail about it and rage about it. You know, the grief just has to pour out of us. And I'll just say one last little thing. This is a candle of joy, which is this is my daughter sitting next to me, and she's been my daughter, you know, like all her life, and she's still blowing my mind. We're here visiting, and she just is knocking me out. Okay, I'll be quiet.
I have a question. A couple of weeks ago, I'm Roger. My name is Roger Johnson, and this is my wife, Linda. Anyway, a couple of weeks ago, Bernie Sanders and former governor of Maryland, Martin O'Malley, were at a conference someplace, and they both proclaimed that Black Lives Matter, and they went further and they said, White Lives Matter. All lives matter, and they were booed off the stage. Can you explain that?
At least in our Unitarian Universalist movement, we're really trying to talk openly about that, and I'm grateful to you for raising it, and I wondered if it would come up in Q&A. Did anyone here go to General Assembly in Portland this year? Oh, awesome. Okay. So on the last day, there was the action of immediate witness debate where people are talking about whether we as a denomination are going to sign off on a particular issue as a statement of our values and something that we're wanting to be really intentional about further actions on. And the topic of the statement of the action of immediate witness was Black Lives Matter. And there were elements that were somewhat complicated in that it was also talking about the prison system and abolition of the prison system, and you know there was wordsmithing from the floor that was going on that in some ways obscured even the larger issue about how we talk about racism in this country. But the thing I think to understand about Black Lives Matter for us as a movement is that we are trying to decenter ourselves as a people, meaning white people, and often people of educational privilege, people of financial privilege, and not all of us have all of those things. Some of us may not have any of those things or at any particular moment. And this is called intersectionality. It means you can be privileged in some ways and be almost down for the count in other ways simultaneously. You know, I didn't grow up with class privilege. I have class privilege now. I've had white skin privilege my whole life. Because of all of those different pieces of intersectionality, it can be really hard for people to get behind the awareness that what we're really talking about is black lives in this moment. The illustration that is so simplistic, but I've heard it work for some people, you've probably heard it, the cancer fundraiser example. Would you run through a cancer fundraiser yelling, "But there are other diseases too!" Right now we are focusing on the black lives because it is black bodies, and it's also brown bodies, quite honestly, that are at an incredibly disproportionate risk of being victims of state violence. Are they the only victims? No. Are the poor sometimes victims? Yes. Can even people with some class privilege who are white become victims in this system in the process of speaking out? Yes. And still we're banding together to say Black Lives Matter, and the biggest, most important part of that is that it encourages us to take a step away from the centering of our own culture, which so often, what is white culture? Like, we have a hard time even conceptualizing that, right? So often what we're talking about is consumerist culture, and we're taking a step away from that when we band together behind Black Lives Matter and then listen to those black voices. We cannot lead that movement. We can only follow and lend it our presence and our allies.
Okay. So, and then the other part of that is police ethics. When I heard Katie tell her story about the traffic incident, I've had similar things happen. Attitudes and ethics of the people who are paid by our taxes to keep the peace and to protect us need a massive overhaul. And until that happens, as well as the military attitude of we can make everything right if we just kill enough people, you know, yeah, that has to change.
You gave us two examples that were very interesting, examples of people who change their conduct when white privilege is brought to their attention. And one was the example of the doctors who seem to have become enlightened. What was the other one? I can't remember. Oh, right. So these are examples from which we could take some hope, you know, that things can be done just by raising consciousness, by bringing these things to people's attention. But I don't know how far we can generalize from those two cases. In the case of the police, it seems to me very unlikely that simply bringing this to consciousness will lead to any radical change in their conduct. I don't know exactly how to distinguish between cases where we can be optimistic and cases in which we can't, but there is a kind of institutionalized racism that is impervious to raising awareness of it. That's my view. So the question... Well, institutions are structured forms of authority that have a systemic and very powerful impact on the society which encompasses them, just roughly speaking. And when racism is embedded in such institutions, then it seems to have a durability that simply moral attention doesn't really affect very deeply. Now, on the other hand, of course, the doctors are part of an institution, so it's not clear to me exactly how these things can be distinguished. But anyhow, those are just my thoughts here. And just for your information, there is an effort here in our own community to reform police conduct with respect to the racial disparities that we now know about who gets arrested for marijuana possession and who doesn't. So we've done the research on it, and we know that with respect to Riley County, Kansas, things are actually getting worse in the last several years for some reasons that we can't quite understand. And we will bring these. We have already brought this to the attention of the police, and we don't think that it's going to be changed without some very serious interventions. So your thoughts on that?
I'll try not to go back and forth in this discussion, but in this case, I do have a couple things that I want to say. The first of which is, you know, those were two examples. We talked about doctors. We talked a little bit about the legal system, and I spent a lot of time talking about myself. And I am wondering, before the next time I give this sermon, if I might make it a little bit more overt. I don't want to smack people over the head, and I think it's really helpful to come at it from the perspective of, like, this is where I've screwed up. I'm hoping, though, that people are willing to draw lines to where in your own lives do you see these kinds of entitled attitudes and behaviors. As Cornel West, who is a black, powerful theologian, he's a butt kicker, and he's on the faculty at Union in New York, and I think he's at Harvard now, but he was the Ware lecturer at GA, and you can watch it. It was live streamed, and it's still up on the GA website. It's 20 minutes that is so worth your time. But he said, this, you know, big black guy, when I look in the mirror sometimes, I see a glint of white supremacy in me, and if there is racism in me, you can be pretty sure that there's some in you. And it's easier for him to say that message than it is for me to say it to you. But I deeply believe that we each have some changes that we can make and reflect on in our own lives, and institutions are made up of people. We forget, and they forget, and we allow them to forget that they were created to serve us, but they are still done by our hands, and their dollars are our dollars. And so I think that it's important that we know that the changes we make in our own heart are important. And then the last comment I'll make about that is, if you were here two sermons ago, I preached about hope, and it feels like there's been some differentiation of the audience for each one of these sermons, but the arc of these sermons was really intentional. I came to you with that hope piece first on purpose, because so often I think we get into this false binary of we have to do this or we have to do that. I hear it in our congregational lives. Are we going to take care of each other, or are we going to go out for social justice in the community? Resist those binaries. It is not an either or, and nothing is ever going to be completely solved before we're pulled to move in a different direction. It's little steps and little bits and little pulling, and you move together in fits and starts. The way that human development happens from the time a baby is learning to talk and walk, we develop that way. Don't give up hope. And you're right that we do have to reform the institutions.
The reason I'm standing up is I have a hard time hearing, and I always struggle to see somebody's face when they're talking. So I would prefer if we were in a circle and we could see everybody's face when they're talking. For me, the elephant in the room for all of us is indigenous people who lived everywhere, and they've become invisible. And I had a horrific moment. Pat and I had gone to Lame Deer. We were in a little town, Asheville, Montana. And there was a service station, you know, that had the big windows, so there's a lot of glass, and you could see it was an abandoned service station, and it had been turned into a food distribution center. And I watched some sort of argument or altercation break out between the indigenous people who were lined up to get cheese or flour or whatever it was they were there to get. And it just, you know, hit me like a load of bricks that this is still going on, and that I've been in social situations where we're talking and people will make comments like, they have casinos, they've got plenty of money. Without knowing anything about them or about their situation, people again and again dismiss them. And this is not good for us. You know, this is the thing that you're, if you are the person, you're cheating yourself if you set yourself up above. And of course, I've wasted lots of time doing that. And fortunately, I've usually been kind of tweaked for it. You know, if I'm discounting somebody else in a funny way, I'll be reminded that in discounting that other person, those other people. And so when politicians start talking about who Americans are, I step way back and I go, okay, let's seriously start looking at who we moved off the land, the massacres that we know about. They're minor. There's lots more. And our very own citizen band and prairie band, Potawatomi, you know, they were trying to fit in. They were living in the Great Lakes area. They were becoming farmers. They were trying to be white. They were adopting Christianity, of all things. And one day, this is the story that I've heard, the history, the tribe was called into their church that they had built. They were locked inside the church, and the people who wanted their land said, we've burned your houses, you're moving to Kansas or across the river, whatever, you're moving. That was enacted far too many times. Is that who we are? You know, that's not who, I didn't personally do that, and that's the other thing that some people say, it's time to move on. Well, great, yes, we should all move on, and but we have to face our own history before we truly move on. Thank you.
I'm going to say something that's probably pretty controversial. However, I think we learn about other people when we engage with them. And I totally agree with much of what has been said, but a concern that I have had over the past year in looking at the particularly the law enforcement issue is that repeatedly I see that in the black community it is not acceptable for you to want to be a cop. And that police are, people who choose that role are discriminated against by their community. And I think that in order for us to make meaningful change, all of us need to learn to work together.
Blessed be. It has been a blessing to be here with you, and I do hope that you will find spaces with each other to continue these conversations, which rightly belong to this community and to your community. I look forward to being back with you in August, and congratulations on the journey that you're walking also towards your ministry with John Aleo. I hope it's a wonderful blessing.